Public Affairs Show is brought to you by a collective of woman-identified radio activists. This show gives a voice to those working for social justice and equality, both locally and globally. Highlighting achievements made by women activists, scholars, and innovators, Bread and Roses strive for excellent programming while still having fun. We here at KBOO strive to give everyone a voice, especially those who don't get as many chances from corporate media. But for us to support these great shows, we need you, our listeners' support. Donate today at kboo.fm/give, and besides supporting our local community radio, you get the chance to win a trip to our neighborhood. The ultimate KBOO Neighborhood Experience raffle package includes several different gift cards to shops in our community, along with a meal and night stay right next door. Come explore what our community is like, again, by donating at kboo.fm/give. See full rules and details at kboo.fm/2019raffle.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, March 4th, Clinton Street Resistance will screen The Great Muppet Caper, where Kermit the Frog, The Great Gonzo, and Fozzie Bear are reporters for the Daily Chronicle, traveling to Britain to report on the theft of the baseball diamond. This week's screening benefits the Circus Project. Again, that's The Great Muppet Caper, showing Monday, March 4th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hello, KBOO listeners. This is Zoe Piliafis, your development director. We worked with our neighbors to provide the ultimate KBOO neighborhood experience. I am here today with Dr. Keenan Davis from Hammer & Nails. What makes neighborhood important?
I believe neighborhood is everything. I mean, when you think about the nexus of what a community can do for its stakeholders, nothing can really evolve without that connectivity that's created through a neighborhood. You know, when we think about KBOO and what it means for this neighborhood, it's about making people feel like they have power. Whatever it is inside of you that hasn't been tapped or realized, that you have that sense of confidence and self-worth because of your community.
We appreciate your time today. For every $20 you contribute to KBOO today, $1 will buy you a chance to win the ultimate KBOO neighborhood experience. The KBOO Foundation's neighborhood experience includes 1 night at Jupiter Hotel, dinner at Doug Fir, and gift certificates to Grindle's, Hammer & Nails, Hattie's Vintage, and Sizzle Pie. Total value $400. 10,000 tickets available. Drawing will be held at 20 Southeast 8 on March 24th. Noon. Go to kboo.fm/give right now.
Want me, man?
KBOO Portland.
Holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meetings policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Finance Committee meets the fourth Monday of every month at 4:30 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to co-sponsor the Law for the People Convention from October 31st through the 4th at the Benson Hotel in Portland. Registration is now open for this five-day conference. Panels and workshops include Facing Fascism, What's the NLG's Role in Defending Resistance to Fascism? Movement Lawyering for Racial Justice. Disaster Capitalism, Colonialism, and Climate Change. what it means to do movement legal support in Indigenous communities, and much more. Again, registration is now open for the Law for the People National Lawyers Guild Convention from October 31st through the 4th at the Benson Hotel, 309 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
I am here with Teresa Rafer, the legend, and I want to introduce you all to this new show. It's called The Struggle. And I want to do this because I know so many brilliant, brilliant people who do activist and organizing work and put their whole heart into it and yet come up against some hurdles. And I find that often it's because they just don't have the time and energy and resources to do some of the outreach to the community, to you, the people that are listening. And I do what I can to share out as many events as I can and share flyers and tell people about what's going on. I sit on the board of Portland Jobs with Justice. That's a solidarity organization that just seeks to turn other people out for other people's struggles. And I feel like I can actually possibly do more. So that's where the struggle comes in. If I can help more people know about struggles that are happening in this city, and the people who organize them are making the pitch to join, to help, to get involved, well, then I feel like I've done one more small part in the larger struggle for justice. I think about the fact that there is injustice at every turn in our society, that we can be a city inside of a state, inside of a nation that was founded on colonial violence, on a settler regime that thought that it was permissible to say to the people that were already here, thank you very much for being stewards of this land. Thank you for keeping it plentiful and bountiful. We'll have that. Goodbye. And I honor, and I hope that we all honor, Indigenous sovereignty and resistance. Winona LaDuke will be at Madison High School tomorrow morning for the Teaching for Social Justice Conference, and I'm very much looking forward to hearing what she has to say. And if you are there, please say hello to me. So I'm disturbed that a country that was founded on this kind of violence can continue to sort of perpetuate itself and propose itself as a progressive force in the world. That seems like a huge lie. That enslaved Africans were made to toil under the threat of death and torture, were made to do so for hundreds of years, and then in an era that they call Reconstruction, have it be overturned by white terror, vigilante violence, and there never really being any repair around that. And yet, when we have disparate outcomes in terms of education, resources, police violence, where we're told that it's the fault of the people who are experiencing the violence themselves. This is horrendous, and it's not easy, and the fight against it is a struggle. So I want to talk about the struggle. There are people who are actively engaged in their communities right now in Portland, Oregon, that come from a legacy of people who are in a radical tradition
And I'm lucky enough to know and love Teresa Rayford, the founder of Don't Shoot Portland, the lead organizer of Don't Shoot Portland. And she's changed my life. So when I got the opportunity to do a show like this, it was obvious that Teresa needs to be the first person who I talk to. So for the next hour, I hope that you find our conversation engaging. Teresa, hi.
Hello, good evening.
Thank you for being here with me. I love you so much.
I love you back.
I'm hoping that you can talk about what your activism was like before Don't Shoot Portland started.
All right. So I didn't even know I was an activist. My nephew got killed in September of 2010, actually September 26th of 2010. His name was Andre Payton. He was born and raised here, his brothers and sisters, mom, dad. His father was my brother. But, you know, we all came from this community. And I just happened to come home to visit while I was living in Texas. And when I came home, you know, my nephew got murdered. And it was a trip because I was involved for whatever reason in the little bit of time that I was here. I was involved in things that were happening in Multnomah County. I was attending meetings on behalf of my mom's church and my grandfather's request with Barbara Wheeler, who was the commissioner at the time for District 2, and what you would call this group of women called the Black Women for Peace. And so in being engaged with that, I thought that my whole idea was just to engage on behalf of my community and enter into some, you know, ideas or innovation in regards to how we could stop the violence. But it ended up becoming a whole 8 years later. It started there, and within 2 weeks of being a part of this organization, sharing my ideas, becoming a steering committee member and worrying about how I was going to be involved in all of this and still get out of town, my nephew got murdered. It seemed like I was already in a circumstance where I was, you know, pivotal in making decisions about safety and influence in our community, and then he was lost to gun violence right down on Northwest 2nd and Cooch.
I'm sorry. So when you tried to get active, or not tried, when you did get active with community organizations, what sort of difficulties did you have? What kind of roadblocks did you experience?
Well, okay, so everything seemed to be going well, good. You know, being connected to all those agencies at the time of his death, you would think that there's a lot of partners that have resources that will take some of the, you know, the experiences of families like mine that had dealt with the violence of gun violence. You would think that having all those partnerships would give you priority or at least some type of opportunity to engage and be influential in some of the things that need to happen in our community to keep the kids safe. But the connectedness of being a victim survivor and then being a branch of a community or a civic-based agency, mm-hmm. It didn't mesh well. It was like they disregarded some of the experiences we had. They disregarded measures for accountability. They disregarded the humanity behind what they thought was just driven data and what we felt were our children and their futures and the health of our community. And so there was a clear, there was, I don't know, the priorities of the different committees, the different boards, the different agencies that were connected to community health in regards to gang violence or gun violence in our community. Their priorities weren't to build resolutions in our community. And as a victim survivor of gun violence, that's where it became an entanglement that we couldn't move forward. And I guess that's when people started calling me an activist. They basically would say, oh, she's an activist or she's protesting. But really, to be mindful, I wanted audits. I wanted outcomes. I wanted them to be influential with some of the state leaders that they had and create laws and hold people accountable. So since they were the people that needed to be accountable because they were the people at the table, that wasn't what we needed to be, you know?
Well, when you say that you didn't think that their priority was resolutions, then what was it?
Money. It was funding. It was money. Basically, when we started doing the audits and we would get back all of these big returns that would show, like, the most recent audit that showed that gang violence in the city hadn't really been investigated and that the priority was just to collect information. The same data would come through all of our systems, that we were counting the demographics of people that were oppressed by different systemic issues. And the collection of that data and the referral agency partnerships seem to be more important than outcomes. Any families that I've advocated for, that I've helped file complaints or lawsuits against agencies or organizations or the state, they felt that their civil rights, their civil liberties were being violated if they signed their children up for programming or community family planning or engagement. They had to waive their FERPA rights, which is the Federal Education Rights to Privacy Act, which allowed other agencies to investigate these families. And again, the priorities of gathering information, of surveilling, of community policing, and then the priority of just safety and health, they weren't in line in the same strategy to get where they need to go.
So when you say that you felt like they were being violated and you were being disregarded, what did that actually look like by community leaders? How did they disregard you? How did they violate these people?
If you look at things now, when my nephew died, you would see the mayor come out, you would see community pastors come out, you would see all these agencies come out, and they would do this whole press conference where they're all standing together and they're denouncing the violence in the community and they're going to make some measure to do something better. But when we started asking for accountability, because every time they would do this, in my mind, I wanted to see, like, what's going to happen? What do you mean there's a resolution if you've been sitting at the same planning table for 25 plus years and it's the same players at the same table? What new innovative idea can you come up with besides community engagement? Because that's not happening. You're only engaging with families that are directly affected by violence. You're not engaging in the community to be proactive, to stop the violence, to address the issues that cause violence. What's the hustle? And indeed, it's a hustle. It's a hustle. You know, in any industry, if there's an issue that needs attention and you can, you know, write a grant or file some legislative tool to say that this is an at-risk or a marginalized or, what do we call it?
At-risk?
At-risk. Mm-hmm. That word.
Oh, I'm at risk.
You're at risk.
Yeah, sure.
You're at risk. I mean, if I can quantify your life and make it according to that demographic and there's funding behind it, well, then I'm kind of, you know, not in the red when I'm dealing with this problem. Mm-hmm. And in my mind, you want that problem to go away. You want the funding to go away. You want the program to go away.
Yeah.
But you even have families whose children have died behind this type of work that they're saying, we have to keep this going. I don't see why.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's mm-hmm. no outcomes. We've had another shooting this morning. I went to Peninsula Park and someone got shot this morning. We had a shooting last week, a couple of shootings this weekend. I mean, mm-hmm. I don't hear anyone addressing any of this on the news. And I think it's because either these agencies are currently being investigated, either they've been indicted, either they're not getting their money anymore because people are demanding accountability, or mm-hmm. they just don't care, but they still meet every other Friday,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
So.
So when you say people are demanding accountability and they're not getting it, I want you to please suss that out for people who are listening, because accountability, like so many other words that we use in social justice work, and I'm not knocking it, mm-hmm. right? I want us to be able to have a common language. I also want that language to be able to be readily understood and even
yes.
popularized. So when we say accountability, like what would that look like in this situation?
Well, let's say direct services. Let's say direct services. Let's say that if you're a community policing partner, if your job is in fact to work with the police, then it's probably not likely that you're a proactive partner in stopping the violence. You're supposed to come when there is violence. You're supposed to support police investigations around people that you deem might be violent. And what I've seen in some of the audits that just came out, and that's where we talk about accountability, accounting, getting these people to put it on the record, it clearly stated that there was no necessary reason to create an intrusion in people's family or to identify everyone as gang members. But when we also talk about accountability, the fact that that's been a practice here for almost 30 years,
What's been a practice?
The gang affiliation, okay. Identifying people as at risk through gangs, mm-hmm. or marginalized through gangs, or, you know. So, but what ends up happening is when you call for help, when you need help, if you're going through domestic violence, if you're dealing with sexual violence, if you're dealing with any type of real health-related community violence, there are barriers to you getting services, because if you're locked into these systems, their thing is to de-escalate within their agency, mm-hmm. because they're deemed a community partner, right? And so if the community partner is the responder to your needs, and the same community partner has lost their respect for you because they're part of also a policing culture, mm-hmm. so their civic engagement and health needs is not mm-hmm. relative to your healthy need mm-hmm. for service, you're not really being provided a service. You're really also a tool of an investigative or a predatory relationship. Mm-hmm. I've noticed it with families who have lost their children to gun violence that is perpetrated by the police this past week. Past month. People being murdered by the police, and then the police facilitating partnerships with different community agencies to connect with the families. Mm-hmm. And it's like, whoa, how does this family hold you accountable? How do they seek civil action against the police for murdering their child? How do they have a fair investigation when the community partnerships that are supposed to assist the family are... they're not impartial. They're basically investigating mm-hmm. on behalf of the city, because they are working either for the city or the health department. And so when we talk about delivering the needs directly to the community, direct mm-hmm. service needs, advocacy, mm-hmm. there is none. There's a lot of branches on the tree that look as if they are social services that are related to supporting families. But a lot of the families I meet with, they feel like they're being investigated. They feel like they're being retaliated against. A lot of them are humiliated. You know that when you're going through some type of trauma, that your emotional resolve is, you know, seriously at risk. But mm-hmm. that's not a factor in receiving or serving our community.
Mm-hmm. I want to hit that last point again, not because it wasn't clear, but because I think it bears repeating. So families that you work directly with, that you see are being humiliated by the people that are supposed to be rendering them a service, mm-hmm. Just talk about why them working with an organization that is a policing partner is a problematic. What about it? And of course, I know, but please talk about it.
Right. Well, we live in a state. I mean, we live in a police state. We live in a situation where right now, in today's current climate, we're seeing that the indoctrination of white supremacy across the nation is closely tied to legislative policy. And a lot of the mandates that we live under our civil government and our communities in regards to policing, their authority over our bodies in so many spaces, it's been targeting. It's getting bigger. You know, there's a bigger target. And so, I mean, like, what are you...
Yeah, well, I want people to understand what you understand about why a family...
Should not have access to the police?
Or should not work with an organization that is partnered with the police.
I'm not saying don't work with all the organizations. I'm saying don't waive your rights to privacy. Okay. Don't negotiate your civil liberties for services that should be rendered to you just because you're a citizen or a resident. And a lot of agencies that we've basically advocated that are basically focused on people of color only, mm-hmm. or some segregated piece of our society, their main interest, the reason that they have the equity connected or the cultural competency connected, is because their data related to different agencies that collect and partner with that. When mm-hmm. we were fighting the core standardized testing and telling families to opt out, mm-hmm. it was because of that same display of sharing information and data and how that concluded to being the proprietary value for our community. And we all know that however businesses are operating, there's no benefit to the people. Mm-hmm. And so, again, when we talk about social services or direct services to people, there has to be a service rendered.
Okay.
You know, it can't just be for identifying and collecting and researching. And I haven't seen a lot of that happening. The mm-hmm. reason that we have so many disparities is because we're not delivering on those distribution resources.
Okay. So all of that was because I think that people who don't already know you and your work should know your background before we jump in to August 9th, 2014. And then Don't Shoot Portland, mm-hmm. right? Because and that's how I met you. That's how a lot of people who we know together met you, but you had a full life before.
Yeah.
So I wanted to give enough time and attention to how you came to this work before we jump into it.
Yeah, I just wanted, I wanted to understand how two generations at the time could be affected by gang violence and gun violence. In the city of Portland, which we know is a very small little town, very cliquish. But to me, if everybody knew everybody and if everybody was framing all of this money and all of this political action and all of these community relationships around stopping the violence, around peace in the community and all this other stuff, where were the outcomes? I mean, we're leading the nation in sexual violence against women in our state. We're leading the nation in illiteracy for our children. Our graduation rates are embarrassing. Mm-hmm. We have the nation. We're leading the nation in hungry children. Mm-hmm. We have children that are coming through the foster care system that are still sleeping in police cars and hotels because we can't even accommodate spaces for them. Mm-hmm. We lead the nation in suicide. I mean, those are all very non-progressive items that are not unusual here.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about keeping Portland weird, I'm always just wondering, like, when are we going to keep it healthy? When are we going to build a safe Portland? When are we going to build a city that we can all love mm-hmm. and benefit from? When are we going to be source-driven and community service-oriented and not so quick to compete or to deflate or deflect from ownership or accountability? Like, our leaders, in my opinion, being a victim survivor of gun violence, being a fourth generation Oregonian, wanting to make change, wanting to utilize my time and energy to do it, why should that seem harmful? Why should that create a system where you're ridiculed by the same people that are supposed to be the service providers in your community?
Mm-hmm.
How humiliating for anyone. But even when you're engaged, as they say, all these communities are not engaged, these people don't care about their children. As you're engaged, you continue to feel the humiliation. You continue to be the target for ridicule. And it's because, you know, you're emotional. You're emotionally tied to the situation. But I don't know how anyone can effectively do anything to make us safer if they're not emotionally tied to the situation.
Oh, my God. Okay. So that's the background. So my lead up is dramatic, but it's dramatic on purpose, and it's because so many people, when you know we're talking about the struggle and about activism in Portland, many people say don't shoot Portland, actually like change the way people resist and protest in this city. And of course, that's not on your or my or any one person's shoulders, right? It's because of the reaction to the Ferguson uprising. Mm-hmm. And before I jump into this, I want to give some background. The Ferguson uprising was after August 9th, 2014. Ferguson, Missouri police officer Darren Wilson killed Michael Brown, 18 years old, just graduated high school. They say that he was shoplifting, and that's been debated, and I don't want to get into the weeds here, but even if he did whatever he did, the intent behind telling us this is to make us think that, well, whatever he did, he was no angel, and maybe even he deserved to be killed. Anyway, after they killed him, his body laid on the summer heated pavement on the ground, the asphalt in the middle of the street for 4.5 hours. And they wouldn't let anyone come close to him, including his mother, who was screaming that she wanted to get her son, and they wouldn't let him. Her name is Leslie McSpadden, by the way. And the community of Ferguson were, yes, outraged by this, but like any other urban rebellion, it's not a one-time infraction that is building for such a monumental surge in activity, where we have since learned that Ferguson's budget had been largely funded by people that had tickets and any number of infractions. It was a mostly black city, but the police department and the people who worked for the municipality were mostly white. So that dimension was very striking to many people who were there, who were poor and working class, and knew very astutely that the people who were sort of looming over them were largely white and not struggling financially, and that legacy is way too rich and deep for someone to overlook and say, oh well, you know, it just is what it is. No, it's not that it is what it is. This is the soup that the Ferguson uprising, you know, sort of like came from. So when this happened, it pushed people over the edge. They had long felt like they were being terrorized by the police in their own community. And this act and the sort of lynching quality of leaving his body for everyone to see made it so that it just was not tenable for business as usual anymore in Ferguson, Missouri. So that's the background. And then that night, and the night after that, and the night after that, and the night after that, the community came out and did not listen when the mayor, the governor, the police chief, everyone, you know, all the way up to even Barack Obama, said, we want peace. We want peace. We want peace. Don't violate the curfew that we're setting for you. Stay in your homes. Get behind a nice preacher. And we'll see what we can do. And the people answered with a resounding no and said, if we don't get no justice,
we don't get no peace.
And that's it. And that's how Ferguson came to be. And people around the country sprang into action and said, okay, we're not gonna let Ferguson be alone here, because in every city in the country, Black people are killed disproportionately in every city. So it's not a one-off. Mm-mm. So there were solidarity actions all over, and Portland was one of them. And it was led by Don't Shoot Portland, because they say that Mike Brown's last words were, hands up, don't shoot. Mm-hmm. So Don't Shoot Portland is started at Dawson Park, mm-hmm. in North Portland, in your old neighborhood.
Yeah.
And can you set the scene?
Yeah, so we did an immediate response in partnership with Amnesty International. I think it was August 11th, and it was a big protest. We did some kind of vigil downtown, and then we were also doing like a MLK march at the Boys and Girls Club right here in Northeast Portland. And it was a trip, because immediately the response, like the Boys and Girls Club over here in Portland is right across the street from the police station. And so immediately a lot of the same people that had been conflicting interests, you know, showing conflicts with some of the things I was doing as an advocate for my nephew and children here in Portland, they were the frontline people saying, hey, don't protest. Hey, get away from over here and everything else. And I was like, wait, hold on. You know, like, we're doing freedom of speech. This is happening across the world. And right now we need to do this because some of the same things, like you said, Melissa, that some of the same things that were happening in St. Louis to black people in that community were also happening in Portland. They were also happening in Baltimore. They were also happening in different municipalities in Los Angeles and Texas and the Midwest and across the country. So we knew what oppression felt like, and we knew what death in the street and murder of a child, what that meant for us. And the fact that it was children and families standing together and building this uprising, the solidarity meant a lot to us. And it even came more to light on August 14th when police attacked and tased and arrested Tiger Rooley, who was a child that went to Roosevelt High School. Him and his brothers and sisters were walking down the street, and they had got a call that kids were kicking signs or garbage cans, and they attacked him. And later found, you know, lied about it. Video surfaced. We got the kids on KBOO with, you know, the person who had recorded it on KBOO. Ty's family ended up getting a lawyer. And even the judge in the end of this basically said, how could you guys lie? Why did you do this to this child? But it was the same thing. Like, you know, what made me feel like we had to keep going was that I thought, well, if they're just attacking kids, if they're chasing them, if they're tasing them, if they're attacking them in this way, if we start teaching the kids know your rights training, maybe we can have them respond in a way that's different. Because, you know, at the time I was thinking, well, maybe it's the response. You know, maybe we're just going to have to start figuring out how to talk to the police so that they're not alarmed in a way to where it becomes physical violence. So the couple of rallies ended up becoming teach-ins. And so we used Dawson Park as a space to just have rallies every single day and to share and to advocate with families and communities. And my personal advocacy started growing bigger because it wasn't just me fighting for my nephew and people in Northeast Portland. We had students from Portland State University that were upset and worried about, you know, the arming of campus police. We had families and different students from different campuses that were talking about racism and discrimination and how the authority of their campus security was impacting their ability to feel safe and to be emotionally safe in these places. And it just became like all the things that I already felt, that I was like, whoa, you know, Portland is being racist to me after being away for so long. Everyone was speaking up. And so my motivation was to help them understand the value of attending meetings, going to committees, sitting on boards, talking to state legislators, connecting with different people that were, you know, representatives or senators in their districts, and just putting it on the record so that there would be a firm trend or some information on the record with our state governments that these issues were actually happening here. Because what I had learned in my advocacy was that courageous conversations and restorative justice meant, hey, we don't have a problem, so there's no reason to investigate this. And when you don't investigate, it never happens. So just wanting to change that trend and having so many people to advocate for, it created a circumstance where we protested for like 3 years straight. Like, it was a nonstop movement for uprising because so much of it was needed here. And then the solidarity with things that were happening across the country continued to inspire people to speak out and to stand up. And after about a year and a half, we had a physical record of documented cases of humiliation, racism, intimidation, retaliation, violence, and all these different things. We had that showing not only in our healthcare and our education and community, but even in the workplace, to the point where, you know, we're helping people file complaints at alarming rates, but still seeing the rejection of these complaints through our state agencies, through our different, you know, processes for due diligence in regards to due process. There were still barriers for people of color and people that lived on the margins to be able to receive access to justice. So just like how you said, if we don't see no justice, then you don't get no peace. We're still out here, but the measure of audits, again, getting all that information on the record and then being able to follow up and say, hey, we need to see what this looks like. Let's audit the system, and being able to see where the tangled language is that prohibits them from providing a service to you. That's where people are able to get their powers. So again, if you ever, and you've magnified our protests because you've been there, but the strategy of them is always to push an exclamation point at the end of something that we've just conquered by doing our research or filings of a complaint or whatever. And you know, we would have a protest in front of the federal building just so that we could send out the OIR reports, and we would pass them out to people with highlighted pages regarding, you know,
in custody.
What do we want to call it? The OIR is a organization that puts together the in custody shootings here in Portland, in custody death and police shootings. Mm-hmm. And so that report comes out every quarter. Mm-hmm. And so we would grab those from the Independent Police Review. Yes. Right there on the first floor of City Hall, and it's accessible to anyone. But we would go in there and grab boxes of them and put them in bags. Mm-hmm. And hand them out at the protests with, again, highlighted information so that people would know where to reference information. And I still do it. All the latest audits I've been in, not only the Independent Police Review, but also up in the auditor's office. And not just curious about things that are happening with the police and public safety, but also, you know, what's happening with our buildings, what's happening with the management of the city. We all have access to that information, but it's how you use that access to engage with our local leaders to make change. And, you know, the continuance of our protest was basically the continuance of education.
Thank you. So in terms of the education piece, right, like, yes, building power through learning information, collecting data, getting your complaints on the record, getting audits. Also, power from below in the streets.
That's where you get the power to get those audits to move.
Yes.
Because people will tell you how unfortunate it is that they don't have any information, or that they don't have the time or energy to get information to make it available to you. But when you're active mm-hmm. and you're protesting, there seems to be a slide in. You don't have to stand there and wait for bureaucrats to tell you what they can do. You can have a couple of thousand people demand, you know, justice now.
Yes.
And we affiliate ourselves in that way. You know, we've used our social media to communicate and to promote information, call to actions, mm-hmm. phone numbers. I've gotten tired, and there's so many groups that have picked up those mantles to where, you know, I don't have to do a lot of that, but there's so many groups pushing out information, sharing meetings and everything.
Critical resistance
Empower Portland. I mean, so many groups. So we're all locked in now.
Yes.
And I give a challenge to all of the groups all the time. Let's lock our community and let's move out into our communities. It's cool that we all understand this, the strategy of data and using it against mm-hmm. itself and demanding audits to make sure that accountability is in place.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's time to continue our outreach and engaging in our communities so that people can know how powerful they are within their own small jurisdictions, so that they can start pushing things forward in mm-hmm. this, you know, in this city.
So I want to go to how the movement for Black Lives began to push in other places after Ferguson. Because if it was just Ferguson, it might have almost been sort of experienced as a one-off.
Mm-hmm.
But then Eric Garner gets choked out by Daniel Pantaleo.
And he actually got choked a month before. He got killed in June, I believe it was. Right before August, but it was that verdict that came out.
Oh, that, yes, yep, thank you.
And when the verdict came out for him to be released, it was like, no way, because, you know, like, no way.
No, the community was outraged and shut down New York City traffic,
mm-hmm.
the bridges and the tunnels, and that's, I mean, like, okay, I'm from New Jersey, in case you couldn't tell. I'm not originally from Portland, Oregon, but what people call traffic here is very funny. I am from near the Holland Tunnel, and anyway, and then Freddie Gray
mm-hmm.
in Baltimore.
Yeah, May 1st we did a all night, all day, shut it down for Freddie Gray.
Yeah.
I believe Prince did the call to action for that one. He started a big revolution around the Freddie Gray murder, and he even wrote a song called Baltimore for Freddie Gray. And, you know, basically it was a solidarity response. We had been following because of the importance of keeping the on-the-ground soldiers in Ferguson funded, motivated, inspired, and all the uprising. The biggest thing was, as the uprisings happened following Ferguson, we created systems to support the different organizers and the different communities that were out there. So our job was to stay tuned mm-hmm. with those communities through the different hashtags that mm-hmm. we were using. And so the solidarity, you know, it was instantaneously. We would get calls from college students. We would get calls from different people that were doing streams, live mm-hmm. streamers became allies. Yeah. You know, people started, including ourselves, started teaching cop watching. Mm-hmm. We had like legal students and lawyers, civil rights attorneys mm-hmm. Teaching Know Your Rights as well as cop watching and what that meant for our movements and how it could help us when we needed to go to court or, you know, because our biggest, most important thing was our protection of free speech. We knew as long as we could use it, we could demand accountability for all the other issues, all the other root cause issues that we had been always dealing with. Mm-hmm. And in protecting the free speech, it meant, you know, stay alive. And we always say on the streets, you know, stay together, stay tight. Yes. But really, in the Black community, it's like, stay together and share this information so if something happens to you, it doesn't stop. You know, we don't expect that we're going to live through revolution. That's not what happens in our community to our heroes.
Okay. So we have to talk about traffic. We have to do it. because it's a big part of the counter revolutionary forces, right? The reaction to our pushing forward is you should be able to protest without blocking traffic because I have somewhere to go. And this is, you know, time and time again, city after city.
It's the same thing with language.
What's wrong with that? Talk about that.
I mean, well, there's language. You're saying blocking traffic when someone's protesting. Are you blocking traffic or are you protesting? You know, I never block anything. I'm always protesting. I don't march. I'm not doing a parade. It's not an event. It's not a celebratory, you know, cruise. It's a protest. And so if my body's not enough, if there's other bodies there, we're literally protesting. We're actively resisting. We're not in, you know, like in any way planning. You've never been to a meeting that I've held, an organizing meeting where we're like, hey, let's go block traffic.
Right.
Let's go shut down a bridge. We're going to go do this thing. We go where we need to go and mm-hmm. we feel the way that we need to feel and we adjust our movement to communicate our message mm-hmm. Of resistance. And so I don't even speak any language in, you know, in regards to blocking nothing. Mm-hmm. I don't block.
Okay. Well.
Blocking.
Well, talk about, because this is your, I feel I like I can't speak on this. So I want you to talk about Black leaders in Portland that have been doing this sort of work for, you know, like before Don't Shoot Portland stepped into this position, you know, they were sort of the go-to for Black resistance, particularly against police brutality. And I think we should be honest and we should say that to a degree, you have been sort of sidelined and Don't Shoot Portland's tactics have been seen as divisive and disruptive and all of that. And I want people to know your response to that critique, please.
Well, I think that our community needs to have access to due process. I don't think that there should be appointed gates or leaders that have to vet us in order to help us get access to justice. And so when we talk about current and historical partners with policing and community agencies and government, anytime you're facilitating a relationship with the same system that is oppressing you, there's not going to be a straight, I don't see how that absolutely can work. I don't see how it can work at all. I think that when an agency is interfering with your life, when their transgressions against you violate your civil liberties, that they need to be held accountable, that it's not your job to make them feel like you have to teach them how to be accountable. I'm not going to go and whisper to the city about how they need to behave. I'm not going to refer them to an equity program or a cultural competent program to teach them how to not be massively filled with white supremacy views when it comes to me utilizing my voice.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's just not my job. I can't, you know, they're not getting my sweat equity to teach them how to be right. But there are people that will do that. And I think that what it does is it legitimizes their opportunity to be violent against us. And that's what I've said. Well, because you have someone that's in contract with you or in partnership with you or is a stakeholder with you, and you've already created a circumstance to where this person is supposed to be the go-to person for a community that is outraged at the way that they're being treated.
Yeah.
But this person is a stakeholder in partnership with the city,
mm-hmm.
the same city that is hurting me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to be able to be treated in an equal measure. That's not a fair assumption for me to be. Let's say I'm suing the city. I'm not going to get a city attorney to sue them. I'm going to hire a different attorney so that I can have an equal measure of fairness
mm-hmm.
and equity in regards to my due process.
Mm-hmm.
I think that we deflect due process when we work with people that are partnered or stakeholders within the city when we're seeking justice against the city.
Wow.
I mean, yeah.
Okay, so I want to go into the future now. So after, let's say, the most heated and populated demonstrations are happening around the city, there's a little bit of like a lull. You know, we should be honest. That was seen as like a defeat, like the movement and the larger struggle for Black freedom and hope to accomplish has been sort of tamped down, and the outrage is not as pronounced in cities across the U.S. That was and still is felt like a defeat for a lot of people.
What do you mean?
That there was not massive protests that continue to happen on a regular basis across the country anymore. There was like a dip in activity.
Well, I mean, you have to realize that people that were on the front line with us, they dipped in activity. When they found a different interest, which was Donald Trump, they said, Black lives don't matter as much. We're going to be mad at Trump. And now we can use this as a political straw for things that we need to do. So when we were still in clear, you know, I mean, like, that was the uprising for us. We had all of the things we had built solidarity and unity over, all the dialogues and all the forums, bystander interventions, all the safety planning. When he became the president, that was the time for communities to start organizing and utilizing the tools that we had gathered from Occupy and through the Black Lives Matter movements. It was like, oh, we're all prepared. But no, we ended up becoming fractured. And I think with the fracturing of that, the solidarity that was showing up was not necessary because they had something else that could be utilized in order to appropriate their response in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And I mentioned it many times, but at the same time, the same day he was being inaugurated, I was in the hospital having a 7-pound tumor removed. So the only thing I could do was watch all of this on TV, get out and try to, you know, voice my concerns to the community, and which I did. But by then, again, we weren't getting the type of solidarity that we needed to stay safe. Like, Quanis Hayes got murdered February 9th, really 1 month after Ted was inaugurated and after Trump was inaugurated. So we see the trend that Portland took.
Mm.
And there's just no solidarity around any of that right now.
Mm.
You know, well, not like there was for Mike Brown.
How might we bring that solidarity back to bear?
I mean, we have to realize the same people that were on the front line, the same agencies, unions, organizations, grassroots, everybody that was out there saying that Mike Brown's life mattered, that Freddie Gray's life mattered, that No Dapple mattered, that all of these different collective indigenous movements, all of those same community members, and we're talking about the, what do we call the white community, the majority community, the people with the resources, the people with the bodies, the people with the influence, what they have to realize is that all of those motivated movements still exist. And those are going to be the things that beat Trump. Supporting those movements, reactivating involvement and engagement with those movements, that's how you get the numbers, because they're not getting them either. You know what I'm saying? I think like the last biggest protest that we've had in Portland was the Women's March. And even when people have tried to duplicate that, it hasn't come to the same legs. It hasn't been that big received. The Children's March was a big deal, but our state leaders and even our local leaders still didn't want to realize that that movement was intersecting intentionally with the Black Lives Matter movement and what we're dealing with in our communities with police brutality. And so again, when we talk about not showing up, voices are not being heard, they're not being documented, they're not being narrated, the media is ignoring them, the leaders are ignoring them, and I think that they believe that as long as they ignore them, then they don't exist, mm-hmm. or they don't have to be accountable to speaking on those issues.
Well, when you bring up the Women's March and the Children's March, and there's a lot of overlap in terms of the leadership around the Democrat Party, I'm thinking about the March for Our Lives, and the righteous fight against gun violence mm-hmm. that they took up. Now, someone with a critical lens might say, that's weird that they're so widely celebrated, and not that they don't deserve it, but Don't Shoot Portland has literally been saying, don't shoot, which is a cry against gun violence, mm-hmm. and has not been celebrated.
And we have children that are activists that weren't invited. I didn't mind that they didn't invite our organization, but one of the things that really hurt was that there's a lot of youth leaders in our organization that are extremely active, and those children were the ones that noticed everything before I could even pay any attention myself. They were like, whoa, what's going on? And they couldn't believe it because they're victim survivors of gun violence and they live right here in the community.
Mm-hmm.
I was holding our banner pretty much by myself because kids were like, we can't do it because, and they weren't being vain or arrogant. They were sad. They were hurt, you know, because they're putting their bodies out there. They see what protest looks like. They know when people show up and they know when they don't.
So why the different response, Saressa?
We live in America.
And what does that mean for?
When we talk about women in America, we're talking about white women. When we talk about children in America, when we don't say kids or disadvantaged or marginalized or at risk, and we say children,
mm-hmm.
we're talking about white children. Mm-hmm. And so that's the difference.
Okay. What is a potential remedy for that? Or the beginning steps of one. If it's unequal.
I mean, how do you can't legislate morality. You can't force morality or any kind of ethics on people.
Right.
You can continue to design what you can as a person, as a consumer, as a resident on planet Earth.
Mm-hmm.
And I use education. I use art. I mm-hmm. use my social experience to basically educate children so that they can be better people than we are, you know, so that they can have more of a desire to serve community, and maybe that will help them be, you know, the leaders that we need one day.
Right.
But I invest so much of my time in their future. I see where we are. I hang out in the archives. I know how hard it is to reconstruct, deconstruct, dismantle patriarchy, and so with the time that's available to me, I just want to make sure that our children understand what that means.
So I think about the resources, right? The people resources, the technological and media mm-hmm. resources, the contacts, the donations. That's why the March for Our Lives was as massive as it was.
Because the people wanted to give.
Yeah.
And that's what you have to want to give. There's, you know.
So I would say, and yes, I'm biased. I've been down with Don't Shoot Portland for years. But I would say if Don't Shoot Portland got supported to that degree, then the children's marches that Don't Shoot Portland puts on would be at a similar caliber.
Absolutely. And the thing is about our marches, we don't take up donations to have the march. We do it and everybody's aware. They show up. And what I've noticed, because I'm so super analytical, is a lot of people over the last 8 years, the work that's been done, you can quantify how many groups have benefited from the privilege of attending some of our protests or being connected to some of the community engagement that we're doing. And so you would think that agencies or partners or community members that have gotten a start or have, you know, fiscal partnerships or you know, opportunities would support us. And so hopefully that's something that'll happen in the future. But that's something that, you know, I've been mindful of because I see the opportunities. We're not lacking for resources in the city of Portland, but Black-led movements, we tend to have to compete for those resources, which is just very so unfortunate.
Yeah. Well, then for people that are interested in supporting Don't Shoot Portland to help with those resources, how do they do it?
They can go to don'tshootpdx.org and there's a donate button and they can donate there. Or they can show up to some of our events. There's a contact box on there. There's a newsletter. We take volunteers. We love volunteers. We have a fundraiser coming up December 1st at PNCA. It's going to be an art auction. We have some amazing work that's going to be auctioned out and some great sponsorship levels to help us with moving into the dismantle, change, build community center with critical resistance and start our legal center, our legal clinic that's going to be kicking off in January. We're also working with Isaka Samsudeen right now on a Juneteenth calendar in partnership with the Arlene Snitzer Foundation and PNCA, and basically this calendar is 24 years of his work that's being developed as like a liberated archives project in partnership with Don't Shoot Portland to bring Black history and civil rights and information about people that the kids probably haven't heard of in their history books, but can utilize this calendar of art and use it as a contribution to their literary understanding of civil rights. So.
So I just want to repeat that the website is where a lot of this information is. So if that sounded like a lot, it's because it is. And
volunteer tomorrow. Feed in. Clothing.